Hello, and welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies. I'm Bryce Bongiovanni, your host and recent graduate student from the University of Georgia. Today, I'm talking to Scott Ickes. Scott is a professor at the University of South Florida and the author of African-Brazilian Culture and Regional Identity in Bahia, Brazil, part of the New World Diaspora series from the University Press of Florida. Scott, I'm so glad to have you with us.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about my book.
Great. So to begin with, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, your academic experience, and how you got drawn to this?
I grew up in Pittsburgh. I grew up in a small steel town in western Pennsylvania, outside of Pittsburgh. I went to Denison University in the 80s. And in the 80s at a small undergraduate college, if you were politically inclined, interested about in the wider world, you pretty much had two choices, and one was to get involved in protests against apartheid and divestiture, or you could look more towards Reagan's policies in Central America and trying to make sense of, you know, where you stood in regard to the U.S. government, the State Department, Jean Kirkpatrick's positions on the Sandinistas and the FMLN in El Salvador. I chose Central America. At that point, then, I went on to do an MA in Central American history. That was going to be one of the ways that I sort of looked to the past to try and make sense of what I'd been studying in the 1980s and early 1990s with regard to the Civil Wars and the Cold War and U.S. policy in Central America. I drifted more towards sort of questions of culture. I became more interested in anthropological ideas of identity, ethnicity, and especially cultural groups or ethnic groups and their relationship to the dominant culture, the state, for example, in Central America. But I was also working with two African historians looking a lot at the relationships between ethnic groups in Africa and the colonial state, but also the post-colonial state as well. So with that set of intellectual interests, I set about putting together a PhD program that was going to get me involved in Guatemalan ethnohistory and looking at the penetration of capitalism from Guatemala City into the Cachiquel-speaking areas outside the city during a dictatorship in the 30s and 40s. And at that point, Darrell Williams, a Brazilianist, came to the University of Maryland where I was doing my work. And I talked to him about my intellectual interests, and we talked about possibly switching over to doing Brazilian history, or at least a minor in Brazilian history. And when he heard the sorts of things that I was actually interested in, he suggested that I look at a similar set of circumstances in the northeast of Brazil, in the state of Bahia, in the 30s and 40s. He was also turning his dissertation into a book, and he was writing on cultural policy, cultural nationalism, and federal institutions during a dictatorship in the 1930s and 40s. And it was a dictatorship that was very keen on deepening its industrialization, processes of modernization, nation state and national identity formation. So the intellectual interest really did line up quite nicely. And there was just a small matter of learning another language, Portuguese, right, in this case, and also the historiography. But Darrell, thankfully, was very supportive and said, you know, if you're willing to take on those challenges, I'm willing to supervise your PhD. That got me started into looking at Bahia.
Right. So where did you get started in this particular question of the public Afro-Brazilian cultural practices in Bahia? Because I think the major aspect of African-Brazilian culture that comes through in your book that is being put to work by different people in Bahia at this time are these public performances of that culture. Public religious performances of candomblé, capoeira, the kind of dance, martial art, samba, and the various, religious festivals, and of course the carnival, all of which are very public, very
obvious spectacles that people are witnessing. And,
yeah.
and what drew you to those that particular topic?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we had, so the period 1930 to 1954, it's known as the Vargas era. It's so named after its leading political figures, Getúlio Vargas. He came into power in 1930 on the back of a military coup. He runs the country as sort of provisional president, then a dictator between 1937 and 1945. There's a sort of an interregnum in his power between 45 and 50. He comes back into power in 1951 as an elected president until 1954, when he ends his political career through suicide. We had a significant amount of historiography on, and it was a burgeoning field, on the Vargas era in the Southeast, Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. And it seemed in the 90s that the next step was to look at how the Vargas era played out and these big processes of industrialization and modernization and national identity formation, how this played out in the regions. And that was then what I was going to look at in the case of Bahia. However, the source base for the 30s and 40s in Bahia was practically non-existent for political and economic history. So this presented an obvious challenge, but it let me off the hook as well, because I didn't really want to write a political and economic history. I really was, not in a traditional sense anyway, I really was much more interested in the culture arena, much more interested in cultural history. And it turns out that that's seemed to have been the place where there was the most dynamism and the most dynamic interaction between the dominant class and the subordinate class. So in this cultural arena, at least in my eyes anyway. And the 30s and 40s in Bahia were also a heyday for social science. Both North American social scientists and Brazilian social scientists were looking at Bahia in the 30s and 40s quite closely, writing rather extensive studies. So Melville Herskovitz was there, Donald Pearson was there, Ruth Landis was there, E. Franklin Frazier was there. You also had Arturo Ramos and Edson Carneiro. Arturo Ramos was a medical psychiatrist, rather important national figure in the social sciences, and Edson Carneiro, as you know, an important local figure in Bahia. These men and women were producing an awful lot of literature, which turned out to be very attractive source material for writing, looking back on and writing a cultural history of the time period. You also had novels from Jorge Amado. You had the Field Notes of Melville and Francis Herskovitz, which went into much more detail about the Candomblé community in particular than their actual published work. There was also some secondary literature in anthropology, looking back on the period, and also Kim Butler's work in history as well. And so there was a nice convergence then of source material to write a cultural history and my own interests in the relationships between the dominant and subordinate class during the Vargas era. So the question was, how did I sort of focus on, arrive at the idea to look more closely at the popular festivals and the carnival to flesh out this cultural history?
Well, I think to begin with, would you tell us a bit about the way that these, that Afro-Brazilian cultural practices are being seen by the dominant class just prior to this period? Because what this book is also about is about a period of great change in how these practices are viewed. So from a time in which they are prescribed and looked down upon to a time in which they are, to some extent, embraced by the dominant class, although, as you write, for very specific reasons and in very specific, sometimes limited ways. So just, What is the situation for the subordinate class, for Afro-Brazilians in Bahia in, say, the late 1920s, just at the cusp of this period in which you're talking about?
Okay. The 1930s a political a mark for political periodization. Prior to the Vargas era, you have Brazil's First Republic, or its Old Republic. The Old Republic began in 1889, 1 year after the abolition of slavery in Brazil in 1888. which meant the next few years, the first few decades of the 20th century, were Brazil's post-abolition period. And it was during this period that black culture, in particular in Bahia, was seen by the white minority elite as uncivilized, barbaric, dooming Brazil, Bahia's future, holding back progress. And Candomblé in particular was seen as primitive and barbaric and superstitious and anti-modern. The main symbol of Bahia nowadays is the African Brazilian Baiana, the woman who has a relationship with Candomblé, the woman of Candomblé, who's also a food peddler in the streets, selling acarajé, sort of a black-eyed pea bean fritter. Hmm. This woman was very pejoratively seen as an emblem of everything that was wrong about Bahia's African Brazilian working class. She was in the streets, and she was a woman. Therefore, that meant she had no honor. She was selling food that was seen to be unhygienic, therefore breaking all sorts of notions of cleanliness associated with progress. And of course, she was associated with Candomblé, which, again, being barbaric and primitive. So she was, in particular, a target. Also targeted was the African Brazilian martial art known as capoeira, which is kind of a combination of sort of dance, performance, and actual fighting art, an actual martial art. This was outlawed, it wasn't outlawed, it was still persecuted by the police. It was again seen as problematic. It was seen as a thing of degeneracy, social marginalization, and not the way that the Bahian elite wanted to see their nation. So Candomblé, capoeira, the individuals associated with this, and also even samba music, despite the fact that it went on to become one of the principal markers of not just Bahianness but Brazilianness. Samba music at the time, the elite had a very uneasy relationship with that as well, because it was also something that was coming up out from the African Bahian working classes. But in particular, drumming, any kind of percussive drumming, music and dance, that was also seen as primitive and barbaric, and keeping people up late at night, which meant they couldn't get to work on time and they couldn't be productive citizens, et cetera, et cetera.
So, as I've said, this is a book, you know, which charts a change from this reality before the 1930s, largely, to something rather different, and where these practices are increasingly being displayed in public with the permission of the dominant class. Sometimes, you know, encouraged by the dominant class, they become symbols of Bahia and even symbols of Brazil in a larger sense. How does that change begin? Where does that start to happen?
It starts to happen in the Southeast with the emergence of a group of artists and intellectuals who were embracing modernism, and a specific Brazilian version of modernism, which was going to celebrate things that were Brazilian. It was going to insist not just on importing culture from the North Atlantic, from Paris, but was going to rework that culture by bringing aspects or facets of Brazilianness into a kind of a cultural dialogue. And part of what was Brazilian that was going to be part of this cultural dialogue between the North Atlantic and modernity and Brazil was African Brazilian traditions, particularly musical traditions. And so, for example, you had a fantastic Brazilian composer, Hector Villa-Lobos, whose innovation was to recompose classical music and importing certain strains of kind of musical compositions from popular music in Brazil. And You know, that's kind of indicative of this sort of merging, which creates a space and sort of drives a little bit of a wedge of acceptance of Brazilian popular culture, Brazilian cultural practices, etc. Now that is happening in the Southeast in the 1920s. In Bahia, there's a slower response, and it's a smaller response, but it's still an important response nonetheless in the cultural area, which is the embrace of Bahian cultural practices by, for example, the author Jorge Amado, who in the very early 30s starts to write socialist realist or Soviet realist type novels about the poverty in Salvador. But he writes them in a way that brings in so much of the African-Brazilian culture. And a number of his protagonists are, in fact, also African-Brazilian from these cultural worlds of candomblé, of capoeira, of samba, etc. And he then is the biggest cultural wedge in the 1930s to sort of open up the possibility of celebrating these practices, at least among artists and intellectuals. Now, there's not a huge artist and intellectual class in Bahia, but but Jorge Amado, of course, once you've got him, how much more do you need? Because he goes on to become, you know, Brazil's most published author, apart from Paulo Coelho, I believe.
One notable thing about Amado's works is not only are Afro-Brazilians his protagonists, but some of his protagonists are, as you point out, based on, to a large extent, actual public figures in the Afro-Brazilian community in Bahia, who are themselves beginning to work towards a greater public acceptance of their religious and cultural practices. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about some of these figures and what they were doing.
Okay. So in addition to the cultural sphere, there's also a political change after 1930 that's very important in Bahia. Bahia, up until 1930, had been governed by the landed oligarchy and agro-export interests. With the arrival of Getúlio Vargas to power in 1930, he nominates governors of the states. And the governor that he nominates for Bahia, his name is Jurici Magalhães. He's not from the landed oligarchy. He's not even from Bahia. He represents the junior military officer, urban, middle-class reformer component of early 20th century Brazil. And when he comes into Bahia, he first has to secure his position politically. And he does this in two ways. He does it, one, by reaching out to the oligarchs, or enough of the oligarchs, and giving them what they need politically to ensure that they will continue to round up the votes and keep Jurici Magalhães in power. But he's also going to try and copy what Getúlio Vargas is doing on the national stage, which is building up a working class support as well, an urban working class support. Now, he goes about doing this in a very clever way. He doesn't clash with the oligarchic interests, which is some of what Vargas was actually doing on the national level. Magalhães doesn't have enough power to do that, so he's got to make his peace with them there. His relationship with the working class, and Brazil, Bahia doesn't have a big industrial working class at this point, so that's not going to get him very far. So I'm suggesting in the book that as an outsider, as somebody who's on board with some of these new intellectual changes in Brazil that accept popular culture, popularly working class culture, the African Brazilian heritage, that he creates a space that facilitates or attracts the possibility of the African Bahians themselves, the practitioners of capoeira, the practitioners of candomblé, to get more involved in pushing for the continuation of this possibility of acceptance, and ultimately, perhaps even, we don't know in the 1930s how this is going to work out, but perhaps even by the 40s, 50s, and 60s, an actual acceptance of candomblé, of African Bahian religious practices as legitimate. And we can see this happening in particular in one moment. It's a sort of a microcosm of this these dynamics, and that's the Afro-Brazilian Congress of 1937, which is hosted in Salvador, and it's headed by Edison Carneiro and a few other of his co-travelers, young Turks, if you will. They had their own rebel academy. They were friends with Jorge Amado. They really wanted to push for the acceptance of candomblé, and they wanted to push for the legitimacy of African-Brazilian cultural practices. And this Congress then, based in Salvador, Edson Carneiro brokered, we don't actually know how it exactly played out. We do know Jurici Magalhães was quite positive about the Congress and actually arranged for there to be some state subsidy for the Congress. In the meantime, Edson Carneiro had good connections within a number of terreiros. Those are the temples of candomblé, and invited ranking to participate in the actual Congress themselves. And a number of these characters, one being Mãe Aninha, or Mother Aninha, who was a candomblé priestess, a very powerful and highly respected priestess in Bahia, she agreed to participate and to actually write up one of the papers that was going to be among the presentations at the Congress. And so that's a moment where you can see the kind of the coming together of the intellectual middle class, the state government, and the actual practitioners of the African Bahian practices themselves in 1937. Another example really quickly was that Magalhães hosted in 1936 or 1937, we're not quite sure what the date was, a capoeira exhibition at the gubernatorial palace. And it was shortly thereafter that the person who oversaw that performance, Mestre Bimba, was given the first official license to train and practice capoeira in the state of Bahia.
So in addition to these kind of specific events involving close relationships between elites and members of either the Afro-Brazilian community or those interested in advancing Afro-Brazilian culture, the Afro-Brazilian Congress, or this kind of involvement with the government in particular cases. There's also, and taking up a large portion of your book, discussion of this sort of social institution of festivals, which are bringing Afro-Brazilian culture into a kind of almost mass culture setting of Bahia, out in the street or in public, very accessible and observed by everyone in the city and everyone, you know, to an extent in Brazilian society. You know, there's so much kind of going on in these festivals, as you point out, like negotiation of religious identity and racial identity going on. I wonder if you can tell us, you know, where do these festivals start to become, where did they become important in this process that you're describing already?
Yeah. Okay. The, when I first started doing the work for, to kind of write a cultural history of the Vargas era in Bahia, the one of the ways to get at working class life and whether there actually were changes in the way people lived, the way people thought about Brazil, the way they thought about their region, the way they thought about what Vargas was doing, their attitudes, their values, whether there was much impact in people's lives emanating from the Southeast. To start that process, I initiated a whole series of oral history interviews. And one, the purpose really was to try and understand more about ordinary people's lives during this time period. And in that sense, it was absolutely brilliant. It was a real sort of eye-opening experience into what mattered, what young people did for fun, where they did it, what was kind of the structure of their social lives outside of the workplace. And one of the things that kept coming up that was important to them was the popular festivals. They wanted to talk about their participation in Carnival. They wanted to talk about not all of them loved Carnival. Some of them loved other religious festivals. So, for example, they loved the parades for Our Lady of Conceição da Praia, or Santa Bárbara, or the waterborne festival for Senhor dos Navegantes, Our Lord of the Navigators. And you can kind of look at the people and divide them up into two different groups. There were the more public ones, the ones who actually got involved in these things, wanted to talk about what they did during Carnival, wanted to talk about where they were during the Festival of Bonfim, for example. And then there were many others who mentioned that they didn't participate too actively, but they were there. They loved to apreciar. They loved to go and observe these rituals. And that sort of clued me in on the power of festival and the public rituals in Bahia that were so extensive that in the book that I look at five or six major festivals. So there wasn't just, you know, one or two, that there was quite a few, and there were a number of others I also could have actually looked at. But I looked at the main ones, and it lined up very strongly with a lot of the theoretical literature on Carnival and a lot of the theoretical literature, Clifford Geertz, for example, and Victor Turner, on the power of festival ritual. And also there was quite a lot happening in historiography and colonial Latin American history too, with festival, and the parades of the viceroys and entering the capital cities and things like that. So that all kind of combined to make me think, right, here is a way to try and move beyond the 1930s. That period of 1930 to 1937 with Judas y Magalhães and the Houses of Candomblé and Capoeira, and see how the shifts, the thin end of the wedge, kind of developed during the dictatorship after 1937 to 1945, and then beyond as well.
I wonder if, just quickly here, what sets Carnival apart from these other festivals? You know, I get a sense in the book that it has a bit to do with the sort of national versus regional scope of that particular celebration. But I wonder if you could, you know, kind of go into that a little bit.
Carnival is, I look at it that they're very similar in that there is a Catholic reason for having a procession on a particular day that's related to a particular saint, or a particular church. The Catholic Church itself, and the people that are associated with the brotherhoods and sisterhoods of that Catholic Church are in charge of organizing the festivities. The actual procession itself. There is a whole series of novenas, masses, and liturgical ceremonies within the church related to the particular saint's day and the parade that's going to accompany it. Meanwhile, outside the church, there's the popular festival, the food stalls, the drink stalls, the stalls that are also selling fruit if the fruit happens to be in season. This area is sort of lit up with strings of lights. There's a lot of people who set up many restaurants, there's chairs, there's places for music, there's a bandstand, there's places to dance. All that happens mostly in the evenings for 2 to 3 days, you know, around that particular saint's day, sometimes a little bit longer. Now, Carnival doesn't have a particular saint, but it obviously has a particular day that Carnival is going to be celebrated. The centerpiece of Carnival, much like the other popular festivals, is a parade. And I think the main difference is going to be that the festivities that happen in the squares outside the church, which are called largos. Those festivities are also happening during Carnival, but they're more organized. They're more organized according to groups of young men and women, or just young women, who want to be part of a wider set of kind of parades and celebrations and coming out publicly to be part of the festivity of Carnival. So Carnival has a wider festive sort of catchment area than the other public festivals. And also, I think I'll stop there, but other things will come up and I can mention them as we go along.
Well, just one thing to point out is that those groups also have, would you say they also have, because they're more organized groups, they have a degree of political and economic and cultural, not even necessarily influence, but they are playing they have a more definite role. That's as opposed to the more nebulous idea of Afro-Brazilians or working class Brazilians as kind of a group. In Carnival, you can point to groups of people who are going out and they are part of organizing this public performance, which is also critical to the tourist economy and to sort of the cultural sense of Brazilianness, but especially Bahian-ness.
Absolutely, absolutely. Carnival was a fantastic opportunity for groups that were strongly identified with the African heritage and African Bahian cultural practices to come out and exhibit. For example, the percussive drumming, the percussive musical performances. Those had been part of Carnival since Carnival began in the 1880s, 1890s in Bahia. And it was those groups were very Afrocentric. One of them called themselves the African Merrymakers. Another group called themselves the African Embassy. They would often dress up in what they perceived to be African clothes, exhibiting, manifesting a kind of an Afrocentric worldview. That is an important component of Carnival that distinguishes it mostly from the other popular festivals. It's a tricky question for me, actually, because when you're in this, you kind of stop asking that kind of question. You know, how is Carnival different from the others? It gets its own chapter, so obviously I've thought about this, but it's catching me a little bit off. But so if I haven't answered it particularly well, just keep pushing.
No, I think that's fine. And in fact, there's also a similarity in all of these festivals, one of which that you point out is that they are extensively covered by journalists, by the media. So I wonder if you could, you know, tell us a little bit about the role that journalists are playing here.
The idea that a discourse of acceptance and of African Bahian practices is going to take place, and that acceptance is also part of a wider reformulation of Bahian regional identity. The main actors involved in that process are the African Bahians themselves, the politicians who come to the popular festivals and subsidize them, and also subsidize Carnival. But the big player in terms of reshaping the dominant discourse is going to be the journalists. And I just want to point out that backing up a little bit, the popular festivals, one of the reasons why they're so central to the acceptance of African Brazilian practices is because, in addition to the Catholic elements of the popular festivals, the procession for the saint, the masses inside the church, there was an awful lot of African Bahian cultural practices involved as well. And so the festivals in the Largo, in the square outside the church, they would often have samba there. They would often have capoeira there, as well as the eating, as well as the drinking, as well as the dancing to jazz bands and things like that. Also, these Catholic saints had their own African Bahian analog within the cosmology of Candomblé. And this syncretism then brought the African Bahian cultural practitioners into the festivals through a different vector than through Catholicism. And so, for example, you have the Our Lord of the Good End, which is celebrated on the second Thursday in January of every year at the Church of Our Lord of the Good End. And there is the high Catholic ritual practices associated with it, but at the same time, there's also a washing of the steps outside the church, at the foot of the church, leading up into the church, which you could consider popular Catholicism. Washings are quite popular in Portugal, and popular Catholicism in Portugal in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. That's something that came over to Bahia as well. But the washing for Our Lord of the Good End isn't just for Our Lord of the Good End. He's also for Oshala, who is a deity within the Candomblé cosmology. And that syncretism then means that these, not just Carnival with its African Bahian percussive groups, for example, not just Carnival has an element of African Bahian cultural practices, but also all these other popular festivals do as well. So the journalists who begin to report more and more on these aspects of the popular festivals play an important role in increasing the acceptance and the language that they use for describing these African Bahian cultural practices is a very positive one, beginning around 1936, 1937. It's a bit ambivalent at first, and it gradually becomes more and more positive, moving up through the 30s and getting into the 40s. And then by the 1950s, the coverage is much greater of the popular festivals themselves. But also within that, the coverage of the African Brazilian, African Bahian elements of the festivals is much greater as well.
Just one example, I note that you described a trend of earlier on, journalists describing Candomblé religious elements as being sort of contained within the Catholic elements. But then, as you said, by the later 40s and the 50s, you have journalists describing the Candomblé elements kind of on their own, and in fact, to some extent, focusing on those as representative of the festivals among Afro-Brazilians, not necessarily to the exclusion of the Catholic elements, but certainly to a much greater extent than they had been earlier in the decade.
Exactly right, and you can see there's a big moment in Carnival as well, which I talk about when the elite clubs and those are the clubs associated with the dominant class, the political and economic elite, the social elite. This is one of their big moments when they build massive, great big floats, at least for the time, and parade through the city as part of Carnival. And in the 1930s, leading up to World War II, and then during World War II, the elite clubs take a real hit economically, and they can't put their floats out there. And so what's left for the press to report on and to talk about is the groups that are filling the gap, the vacuum. And the groups that are filling the vacuum are the small carnival associations known as blocos or cordões, sort of blocks, cordons, but also the African Bahian batucadas, which are a single file group of between 9 and 20 young men, almost exclusively young men, playing percussive instruments and weaving their way through the city. There's also the afrochés, which are the public extension of candomblé song and music, reshaped more secular versions to be performed during Carnival. And so you have these small groups that the newspapers start to eulogize and talk about as being, you know, the real heart and soul of Carnival. And it's not just the batucadas, it's not just the afrochés, but the role of the batucadas and the afrochés is quite central in this moment when popular Carnival, not elite Carnival, but popular Carnival, is really seizing the imagination of the journalists in Bahia.
And yet, despite the kind of growing acceptance of the popular aspects of the carnival or of festivals in general, of Afro-Brazilian culture, Afro-Bahian culture in general, as you point out, there are limitations on this acceptance throughout this entire time. Right? Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the points in which the dominant culture was not willing to accept Afro-Brazilian culture on all of its points.
Yeah. You know what, when I was in Bahia early on in the research process, one of the things that it's always seemed contradictory and was partly why I got into asking the questions I did was associated with African Bahian culture and even the African-Brazilian aesthetic. But at the same time, in my conversations with your average Bahian, and particularly conversations with somebody in the middle class or the upper class, you know, I would hear things that to me seemed very disparaging about African Bahian culture. And it still seemed like there was an awful lot of, it wasn't quite the degree of kind of disgust that I'd heard in Guatemala, for example, about indigenous Guatemalans from the white middle class and upper class in Guatemala City. But it had those tones to it. And it was that contrast of something that's so massively accepted and the kind of the public face of Bahia and central to its regional identity is also rather harshly critiqued by wealthy or not working class Bahians at the same time. That critique nowadays is still a continuation of a critique that as we talked about earlier, comes out of, you know, the 19th century, the early 20th century. It hasn't gone away. And one of the things that I thought it was important to call attention to as we discussed this kind of cultural inclusion and the creation of Bahian identity was that it had its limits, that cultural politics, the coming together of middle class artists and intellectuals, of some political figures, of journalists who occasionally were members of the artistic and intellectual middle class, but also the African Bahian practitioners themselves, the people in the Batucadas, the leaders of the Batucadas, the priests and priestesses of Candomblé, Capoeira leadership, that kind of coming together to kind of push for this idea of inclusion was, you know, a very positive step forward in relation to what had gone on before 1930, but it had its limits. And to try and explore those limits and how those limits were established was, I think, very important to understanding just how far cultural politics went in the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s. And it might also help kind of makes sense as well of Bahia's current situation. So I was quite interested in trying to explore this cultural inclusion in a way that might help me understand better, or all of us understand better, what the situation was like in Bahia in terms of cultural inclusion, but this very stark racial and class-based inequality that plagues Salvador to this very day.
There's an interesting point there, which is the sense that there are behind these sort of dominant class acts of reaching out to Afro-Brazilian culture, behind their degree of acceptance that they're willing to extend to Afro-Brazilian culture, there are some, to some extent, very kind of shrewd political and economic goals going on here, both by the Vargas regime in the 30s and 40s, but also by Bahian elites with their own regional interests. To what extent, I would say, do you think this is motivated, this acceptance of Afro-Brazilian culture is motivated by economic or political self-interest?
A continuum. A number of sort of journalists who had quite progressive positions on a number of issues, you know, were also championing this cultural inclusion. And I wouldn't put too much down to, you know, cynicism on their part. I think as you move into the realm of more formal politics, then it's pretty suggestive that there's an awful lot of convenience here. And it comes from the fact that you have this phenomenal parallel going on between events at the national level and events at the regional level. And at the national level, you still have Getulio Vargas in the 1950s having championed capoeira by referring to it as Brazil's national fighting style, shaking the hands of Mestre Bimba, the same person who was at the gubernatorial palace in 1936 under Jurici Magalhães, giving a capoeira exhibition in Bahia. You have the rise of samba to becoming a national musical icon of Brazil. You have the role, the importance of carnival in national identity and in the national capital, Rio de Janeiro. And carnival, the schools, the groups that prayed at carnival were called samba schools. Bahia had a claim to having a role in the creation of the music samba, not least because Bahians had migrated from Bahia in the late 19th, early 20th century to Rio de Janeiro, and had kind of put their cultural traditions into the musical mix that was there already. The samba schools themselves had a requirement to have a wing of baianas, women dressed up as baianas from Bahia, actually dancing in the carnival in Rio de Janeiro, sort of expressing those links in their own kind of public performative moment there. So if that's all happening at the national level, Bahians who were either being cynical or otherwise could see that it benefited Bahia and it to go ahead and piggyback and to continue things about samba in Bahia and candomblé and capoeira during the popular festivals, to continually refer to the fact that these were now icons of Brazilianness, and that this was a way, a very clear way, not think so much about politicians, but maybe think about Rodrigo Tavares, a newspaper editor, director of two newspapers in Bahia, a very kind of astute political individual, very aware of which way the national winds were blowing, very keen on processes of sort of development, of modernization for Brazil, also for Bahia, perhaps eventually kind of seeing Bahia as a little bit behind the Southeast, but wanting to catch up. He, I would say, has both progressive sentiments up to a point that this cultural inclusion, this acceptance of these practices is the right thing to do. It is the democratic thing to do. But at the same time, it's going to help Bahia hitch its wagon to the success of development processes in the Southeast, in Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro.
So it's not something that can be described simply as elites taking advantage of Afro-Brazilians. It's a mixture of kind of, as you say, progressivism and economic and political concerns going on there. And it does, yeah, however, not quite reach to the level of full equality.
No, it doesn't. And I take pains in the book to point this out almost at the end of every chapter, and certainly in the conclusion, that including African Bahian cultural practices into the wider mix of culture that represents Bahia. Within that wider mix, you also have a cultural hierarchy, and accepting capoeira or accepting candomblé into Bahianness, the codification of that is not going to equivalate it with Catholicism, with the Catholic Church, with a law degree, with a medical degree, with notions of science, of progress, and so forth. So the journalists weren't losing control of their acceptance of African Bahian practices, and the politicians certainly weren't either. It didn't happen that often. It didn't happen every day. It happened during certain symbolic moments. It turned out to be very powerful, but also reached their limits. And this is one of the issues going forward and into the 50s and 60s and 70s, which I don't do. And in fact, there's very little written on that time period. But to see more about how that cultural inclusion, that cultural political framework, continued to be a frame of reference for African Bahians themselves and for their middle class allies, kind of push for greater recognition and even perhaps political and economic inclusion. My sense from doing some additional research for the next project and also reading the historiography, also reading a little bit about economic development in the 50s and 60s, one of the things that we're seeing is that even Odorico Tavares seems to shift away from a register of inclusion as a kind of a Brazilian way of creating democracy through cultural mixing, to more of a focus on development, and that it's actually going to be development and economic growth that's going to bring African Bahians and African Brazilians into the mix even further.
Well, that's actually great, because we're almost out of time here. So could you tell us a little bit about this new project, just before we end?
Okay. The direction that I'm going now is exactly this, to see after 1954, after 1955, when Bahia starts to focus much more on developmentalism and they move from economic emphases and policies that support agro-export to policies and emphases that support state-directed industrial development. Now, that's going to be on the back of the development of oil and the oil industry in Bahia. And it's a rather slow process, but it takes everybody's attention and focuses it on developmentalism. And again, there's a wider national trend as well in the late 50s, early 60s, which is hyper-developmentalist, progress and modern, and those become the key watchwords. And this is the period when the great modernist city, Brasilia, the new national capital, is actually constructed. So again, Bahia and elites are following the national trends and hooking themselves to those sorts of developments. But in this case, they see it as there's a stronger link than just culture, because Bahia has the oil. Bahia is the main supplier for domestic oil for Brazil for the next 30 years or so. So what in the midst of all this developmentalism happens to, it's going to be hard to work out what happens to the African Bahian working class itself, but what happens to the discourse, the cultural framework that was set up in the 30s, 40s, and 50s? Does it go into some sort of hibernation? Is there still, does it take a different form? Does it start to include more notions of developmentalism? Because we know that in the 1970s, from 1974, there's a kind of a culturalist revival in Bahia, a very Afrocentric new cultural politics with the founding of ILEAIE and carnival associations. Known as Blocos Afros, of which there come to be over 1,000 of them in the 1980s in Bahia. But what happened in between? What happened in between the period I look at and then this sort of reflorescence in the 1970s?
Well, we'll be interested to find out. Looking forward to your next work.
Thanks. Thank you.
Scott Ickes, thank you for being on the show.
I really appreciate it, Bryce. Thank you very much.